All right. Well, I thought Pastor Vaughn had the more challenging section, or actually the easier section. And then I saw you guys tear him apart. So thankfully, mine's a little more complex. If you start tearing me apart, I'll just confuse all the issues together. Mine is the doctrine of sin. So sin, we're going to talk about sin in general. First, definition. Mike Dean, catechism. Sin is any lack of conformity to or transgression of the law of God.
It's a trick question.
It was a trick question, no. And I'll add this, an act, attitude, or nature. All right, any lack of conformity to the law of God or transgression of the law of God, an act, attitude, or nature. So in acts, individual acts, stealing, lying, murdering, attitudes, think of the last commandment of the Ten Commandments, all right, don't covet. What is that getting to? That's really getting to attitude. Don't covet your neighbor's wife, you know, don't desire to commit adultery. Don't covet your neighbor's car, don't desire to steal it or be jealous about it. Attitudes. Sermon on the Mount talks about anger and lust as sin. And then nature. Ephesians 2:3, one of my favorite verses when I'm sharing with people, it says, we were by nature children of wrath. We were by nature children of wrath. So before redemption, we were sinners by nature. The unredeemed have a bent towards sin. I'm not going to talk about the origin of sin. Hopefully we know that story. But I am going to talk about original sin in reference to the story of Adam and Eve in the garden. So what is original sin? Well, in a very literal sense, it was the very first sin committed by a human. All right, obviously at that point, Adam's being tempted and Eve is being tempted by the serpent. So there'd already been a fall in the angelic world. Scriptures don't say too much about it, but we can at least surmise that much. So Adam's first sin, that's what when we talk about original sin, it was that when Adam was originally created, he had a bent towards good, an inclination to do good, to be holy. And he had what theologians call posse non peccara. He was able not to sin. Able not to sin. So he was created in such a way that he actually had the ability to not sin. When he sinned, he reoriented himself. And so his inclination changed. His inclination to do good changed from an inclination that was bent towards good and holiness and was now an inclination or a disposition to do evil.
If he was incapable, how did he become able?
What's that?
If he was incapable of sin.
Well, he was able, that's why it's able to not sin, meaning he had the ability to not sin. But at the same time, good question, Chris, he was also posse peccara. He was able to sin. So he was both. He had the ability to sin and he had the ability to not sin. And what's important about that is that in choosing the good, we see that we don't know how many times, we really don't hear many things about what happened in the garden, but he chose the good. And he chose the good and he chose the good. And then he came to a point where he chose the bad. What's important about that is that he had willingly changed from choosing the good to choosing the evil. So it was possible for Adam to sin, and here's really what's getting to your point, but it wasn't necessary. So he was able to not sin. It wasn't necessary for him to sin. And why is that? Because God gave Adam a holiness that was mutable. It could be, his holiness could be changed. So he had a holiness that was mutable. So he could basically choose to sin and then expel his holiness. So that is, this is pre-fallen humanity. When you get to fallen humanity, you get to Abel. Make sure I get this term right. Yeah, non posa, non peccara. Not able to not sin. You gotta love double negatives. He was not able to not sin, which means he only had the ability to sin. Fallen man only has the ability to sin. You give him a choice, he's going to choose sin. In when it comes to spiritual good. We'll get to that in a sec. So fallen humanity is not able to not sin. All fallen humanity can do is sin and sin and sin and sin and sin. Redeemed humanity which is us, right?
Amen.
Essentially goes back to this pre-fallen humanity. We have the ability to not sin. Of course, we also have the ability to sin. And then my favorite, glorified humanity. Non posa peccara. Not able to sin.
I had a quick question about that.
Yeah.
For redeemed humanity, is it more a matter of reconciliation with the Spirit of God and receiving direction from the Spirit, or does it really have more to do with the penalty of the law being satisfied and sin not having power over us, or...
Yeah, I mean, Rome, yeah, that definitely plays into it. I mean, but when we're regenerated, our bent is back to the good. Might not feel like it.
Right.
But we have that bent.
As a result of what? That's my question.
As a result of being the new creation, 2 Corinthians. So we've been regenerated, we've been made anew, and our disposition towards sin is changed from only being able to sin. And as sinners, as unbelievers, all we can do is choose to not love God, essentially. We will never choose that. You could even give them every single unbeliever that option, and they will never choose to do anything whatsoever in God's sight that is good in regards to loving Him. Does that mean that they won't do charitable things, set up charitable foundations, do good works, have awesome relationships with their wives or children? No, but when it comes to the aspect of relationship with God, the supreme command being love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength, fallen man never chooses that. In fact, he can't choose it because he has a sinful nature. He has a disposition to sin. So glorified humanity, not able to sin, means we have an immutable holiness. I was talking with someone the other day about this, about what, when we're glorified, is it possible for us to sin? And I said, I hope not. That'd be quite a bummer. So we will never sin again. They were trying to understand, well, how does that work, experientially? Because we've never really had that sense of not being able to sin. The best that I could come up with, which was probably not the greatest, or is a weak illustration, is, you ever been to like a summer camp, or you go to a men's retreat, and it's just this awesome time, and the entire time that you're there, It's like you're on this spiritual high. And the thought of doing anything against God, committing any type of sin, is like the farthest thing possible from your mind. Well, if you take that to the, you know, millionth degree and multiply that spiritual high, I mean, that's what it's going to be like in heaven, where it won't ever cross our mind to even think of doing something like that. I mean, we're going to be in God's presence.
You had that conversation because they were wanting to know if there could be a second redemption.
Right. They told you about it. So original sin. There's five views. When we talk about original sin, there's basically five views of how we are culpable, essentially, for Adam's sin. When you talk about original sin, it is the guilt and the tendency to sin that all people inherit from Adam. The guilt and the tendency to sin that all people inherit from Adam. Let's read Romans chapter 5. That's the primary text that this whole system of imputation and original sin focuses on.
That statement that you just said, are you saying that's the first view?
What's that?
Are you
No,
sorry. Original sin, or are you
no.
saying that's the first view?
I'm defining original sin. Yeah.
We're defending it.
Romans 5, 12 through 21. Who wants to read that? Jim? This coming from the eyeglass doctor, right? All right, who else would like to read that? Okay, yeah.
Okay, 12 through 21.
Yeah.
Okay. Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man and death, through sin and on this way death came to all men, because all sin. For before the law was given, sin was in the world. But sin is not taken into account when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking with men, as did Adam, who was the pattern of the one to come. But the gift is not like the trespass. For if the man dies by the trespass of the one man, how much more did God's grace and the gift that came by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, overflow to the man? Again, the gift of God is not like the result of the one man's sin. The judgment followed one sin and brought condemnation. But the gift followed many trespasses and brought justification. For if by the trespass of one man, death reigned through that one man, how much more will those who receive God's abundant provisions of grace and of the gift of righteousness reign in the life through one man, Jesus Christ? Consequently, just as the result of one trespass was condemnation for all men, so also the result of one act of righteousness was justification that brings life for all men. For just as through the disobedience of one man, the many were made sinners, so also through the obedience of the one man, the many will be made righteous. The law was added so that the trespass might increase. But where sin increased, grace increased all the more. So that just as sin reigned in death, so also grace might reign through righteousness to bring eternal life to Jesus Christ our Lord.
Good. Thank you. When you come to the issue of original sin, one of the questions, or actually a number of the questions that you're trying to answer is, in what sense did we participate in Adam's sin? In what sense did we participate? I mean, did we actually sin? If we did, how was that done? And if we did not sin, why are we accountable for it? So why is this important? Because you have to answer the question, what are we holding people accountable for? You know, what are they being held? Are they being held accountable for something that they had essentially no ability to control to begin with? And then the question is, you know, what is being imputed to us? Imputed meaning, you know, basically you're giving something and it's given to you as if you owned it and were accountable for it. Imputation. So in other words, what are we being given and having it considered as our own? What are we responsible for and why? First, William Shedd, if you've ever read him, actually a number of years ago in LLI, we actually went through parts of Shedd's dogmatic theology. The first view that he actually talks about is you can actually just simply just accept it as a revelation from the Lord, which it is, and then just take it by faith. You know, kind of like creation, ex nihilo. We're created, everything we see, out of nothing. We take that on faith, and that's good. We can do that the same thing with original sin. We read it in the Bible, we take it on faith, we believe it, that's good. Yes?
But still understand the part missing from one of that. Why are we counted out of heaven? But why do we have a right to be in God, be in heaven, God's grace in the first place?
Yeah.
We don't have it naturally anymore.
Right.
I mean, it's not that we lost it, we just don't have it.
Right.
There's no right that exists that we would have lost.
That's where the imputation of Adam is compared to the imputation of Christ. And that actually becomes very important in this whole argument. And one of the views that holds to that makes that there's a parallel correspondence one-to-one. Adam's imputation, Christ's imputation. So yeah, we'll get to that. So the first view is just simply hold it by faith. And you know, that's actually not a bad view to hold sometimes. Especially if you're a new believer. We're going through the attributes of God. I kind of used a couple months ago when we went through Burkhoff. I used it as an opportunity to teach through some of the attributes of God at our college group and high school group on Saturday nights. And some of them, you know, a couple times I've been like, you know, because I'm really trying to drive home the questions and really get them to think about some of these different attributes, his omniscience, his omnipotence, you know, what does that mean? What does that have implications for? And they're all like, well, at some point we really just need to, you know, accept this by faith. And we do accept it by faith, then some of us get to the point where we want to say, okay, now that I've accepted that by faith, how does that work out? You know, what are the practical implications of that as I start to read the scriptures and study it? And so I assume that most of you are here because you've accepted many of these things by faith, you've read them, you've understood them, and now you're kind of like, okay, now let's go a little bit deeper. So nothing wrong with the first view. Hey, original sin, I believe in it. It happened. I'm good.
Isn't that evidence in our lives, though? I mean, our selfishness and guilt, the two things that we struggle with the most, that create the most separation not only from God, but our relationships with others. Isn't that evidence enough that original sin still plays a part? Or, I mean, isn't that...
In our lives?
If we were to scientifically look for evidence that's repeating itself.
Sure. Right.
Selfishness and guilt are the two aspects that... It creates separation from God as well as what we experience every day. It creates depression and frustration and everything else.
Yep. Yeah, you could definitely take it, from a philosophical point of view. You could definitely take this from some different angles. So that's really the first view. The second view is that original sin is because of a natural or substantial union with Adam, which is to say when Adam bit the fruit, we were in Adam. Theologians even use the term seminally. We were there. We were there at the moment he was biting the fruit. And because of that, because we were there, we participated in the sin with him. Therefore, we're culpable of it. So that's the second view, is that it's from a natural union. Some theologians call it a substantial union. In this way, sin is imputed deservedly because in a generic manner it was committed by all of posterity. Hebrews even mentions this when it talks about the tithes, and it's talking about Melchizedek. And actually, well, let's just turn there because I won't do a good job explaining that. I think it's Hebrews 7. So this is talking about the order of Melchizedek. We'll start in verse 4. It says, "See how great this man was to whom Abraham, the patriarch gave a tenth of the spoils. So if you remember the story in Genesis, you know, Abraham defeats the kings. Melchizedek comes out to meet him. He gives him a tenth of the spoils. So he's saying, see how great this man Melchizedek was, that Abraham, our great patriarch, gave a tenth of the spoils. And those descendants of Levi who received the priestly office have a commandment in the law to take tithes from the people, that is from their brothers, though these also are descended from Abraham. But this man who does not have his descent from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. It is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. Okay, so what is he saying there? Melchizedek is about to bless Abraham. In the one case, tithes are received by mortal men, but in the other case, by one of whom it is testified that he lives. And then here's what I'm referring to. One might even say that Levi himself, who receives tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestor when Melchizedek met him. So that term, in the loins of his ancestor, and he's, you know, the whole argument he's making, you know, is that basically Levi was in Abraham giving the tithes. Melchizedek's priesthood is greater than the Aaronic priesthood, the priesthood of Aaron. That's the whole argument. But he uses that Levi basically was the inferior one because Melchizedek came out and blessed. The superior blesses the inferior. So Levi is in Abraham's loins and he gets blessed. Obviously he is the inferior one, therefore the Aaronic priesthood is the inferior priesthood. All that to say, that's would be the argument when you're talking about the original sin being because of a natural union with Adam. We were in his loins, so to speak. So he sinned, we sinned. That's the second view. Third view of original sin is, and most of you have read Doug Wilson's books, are probably familiar with this, a representative union with Adam. So Adam, as an individual, distinct from the posterity in whom we were not present, he was the representative. He was the covenant head for all of us. As our representative, he sinned. Therefore, because of his sin, God imputes the sin to us. Some would even say God undeservedly imputes the sin to us. We were represented by him. And the representation was not a good representation. Well, we'll get to that. So that's the third view. Fourth view is original sin is a combination of natural and representative union. Natural and representative union. Some people believe that, again, you're just combining the two. Not only were we in the loins, he was the head of the human race, but he was also the covenant head of our relationship with the Lord. He was the representative. So we actually, in both fashions, were there. Some people have issues with that because you end up running into what they would say are logical discrepancies, which I probably wouldn't agree with. Then the fifth one, which is not popular and most people don't believe it, but since it's there, I'll give it to you. Adam acted as an individual for the individuals of his posterity. The latter are not guilty of his first sin, either in the sense of culpability or of obligation to punishment, but they are exposed to basically the effects of his sin, physical suffering, death. Basically, Adam messed it up for all of us, and because of that, we have this original sin where we experience suffering, pain, trauma. But there's no guilt, essentially.
So we experience consequences
of his sin, but it's no in no way really imputed. No sin is imputed to us.
Can I ask a question about that? Why is that the viable thing?
Well, because the Romans passage that we're going to look at in a second is, most people agree that kind of puts it to rest.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wouldn't the implication of that view be that children are born innocent?
If you really start taking it to its furthest extreme, then you really get into not even semi-Pelagianism, but you get into Pelagianism, yeah, where kids are born inherently neutral, and then they kind of decide, and there's no bent basically at all to begin with. Now, those who argue for a representative union essentially use what Bernie was asking about, was that you see this parallel between Adam in us and then Christ in us. And so if you turn back to Romans, the whole section there is that comparison that he's making. So it says, verse 12, just as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. Yet death reigned from Adam to Moses, even though those whose sinning was not like the transgression of Adam, who was a type of the one who was to come. So he's talking here about Adam. But the free gift is not like the trespass. For if many died through one man's trespass, much more have the grace of God and the free gift by the grace of that one man, Jesus Christ, abounded for many. Here begins the comparison. And the free gift is not like the result of that one man's sin. For the judgment following trespass brought condemnation, but the free gift following many trespasses brought justification. So, condemnation, justification. For if because of one man's trespass death reigned through that one man, much more will those who receive the abundance of grace and the free gift of righteousness reign in life through the one man, Jesus Christ. So, death with Adam, life with Jesus. Going on. Therefore, as one trespass led to condemnation for all men, so one act of righteousness leads to justification in life for all men. Again, the parallel. One trespass messed it up for all of us. The one sin destroyed it all. The one act of righteousness restores it. For as by the one man's disobedience the many were made sinners, so by the one man's obedience the many will be made righteous. Okay? Same thing. So proponents of the representative union argue that you don't see Christ in any type of race union. You know, when we are in Christ, it has nothing to do with his Jewish blood, his physicality. It has to do with what he did for us on the cross in a physical body in our spiritual relationship with the Lord. There's no race union, as those would argue, a natural union in terms of original sin. Proponents of this view also say and argue that the imputation of Adam's sin was undeserved. Okay? He represented us. He made a horrible decision. We received the penalty for that sin because God undeservedly imputed the sin and the guilt of the sin onto us. But they are quick to point out that as undeserved as it was for that to occur, it was just as undeserved for Christ to pour out his righteousness upon us. So again, they argue from a correlation. It was undeserved for that to occur, but it were undeserved of Christ's merit. So those are the five views. Most theologians seem to tend towards the representative union. Some of them go more towards a combination. Shed and others see problems with trying to argue a natural union and a representative union. I think you could argue pretty strongly from Hebrews for a natural union, or at least for a natural and representative union. I probably tend more towards a representative union, and which really gets into the whole idea of the imputation. Because when you get into the imputation, there's really three views. Burkhoff describes it in just a couple short paragraphs, which he does a great job. I wish it was as easy as he makes it easy to be. The three views, the realistic theory. God created one general human nature, and then that nature was fallen. And so then every time there was someone was procreated, then Adam's nature is divided. You know, so they have Seth and Abel and Cain, you know, so now it's divided into four parts. And then they have kids, and it keeps getting divided and divided and divided. Well, one problem with that is that then it would seem to indicate that we're not only responsible for Adam's original sin, we'd be responsible for all his sin. I mean, if it's keeping, if the nature is being passed down and passed down and passed down, then it's the cumulative nature of what he is passing down, which would be all of his sin. Not only would it be all his sin, it'd be all his predecessor's sin. So this wouldn't explain why we are responsible only for the first sin of Adam and not for the rest, if you tried to hold to something where the nature is being divided up. It also has problems when you get to Christology, because Christ had a human nature, right? And so if the human nature is being divided and that sin is shared with it, then you really run into problems when you get to Christ having that human nature. That's the realistic theory. The immediate imputation, it basically means that the sinful nature is inherited from Adam. The sinful nature is inherited from Adam. The immediate, M-E-D-I-A-T-E. They are, would argue, someone who believes this, is that we are guilty because we have a sin nature from Adam. So the corruption of nature which is inherited from Adam is changeable upon each individual as sin and guilt. But the act of transgressing the probationary statute given in Edom is not chargeable. I meant chargeable. The corruption of nature which is inherited from Adam is chargeable. Basically, the sin nature is passed on. That is chargeable upon each person. The first sin is not passed on. That's immediate imputation. Don't get it confused with immediate.
Can I ask a question, Mike, real quick? How do you respond to people who bring up the objection that if a young child dies before they have the ability to willfully accept Christ, how does God do their sin when they stand before God? How do you respond to that? Because I run into that off and on, and I'm not sure where I'm at with that.
Well, some people believe in an age of, I guess, accountability is somewhat popular. You know, the scriptures really don't seem to indicate anything about an age of accountability. You know, what I'd probably look at two scriptures if I was examining that issue and talking with someone about it. One is it talks about John the Baptist in the womb being filled with the Holy Spirit. So we can at least surmise that it is possible in the womb somehow for a child to be filled with the Spirit. The second one I would argue from is when David's first son with Bathsheba dies. And he says, you know, after he's dead, he will not come to me. I will go to him. Which gives this idea that I'm going to be reunited with him one day again. So, ultimately, we know that God can do that. I think 1 Corinthians 7, some people might use, I think it's 1 Corinthians 7 where it talks about if one of the spouses is saved, the family is sanctified. Then you get people that might argue that if it's a Christian family, or at least one of the spouses is a Christian, then the children, if they died, you know, would go to heaven or something, you know. But you have to answer that question when you're talking with people, because you have, you know, infants dying, and that's where this issue becomes important of original sin, because they've never consciously committed a sin, right?
My next question.
Yeah.
Yeah, what you're asking.
Sure. You want me to clarify?
You clarify what you just asked me.
Yeah, I guess my question is, if we're born with imputed sin, I mean, we have a natural sin nature and stand, you know, guilty before God, is there any other way to be reckoned righteous? You know, if God's going to judge us for the light that we've been given and so forth. And I guess that's my question. You know, can an aborted baby be presented before God, stand before God, and be reckoned righteous, even though they never heard the gospel? You know, that's kind of my question.
That's right. I just wanted to clarify.
And I'm not sure that that can.
Sorry, are you asking if there's salvation apart from the gospel?
Not really. I mean, what I'm asking is, like Mike's bringing up, you know, before a baby's even born, is there, at the heart level, a righteousness that can occur before God in a person, you know? And I don't know that I would say there isn't, you know? When I hear people talking about babies immediately going into hell because they never heard the gospel. I struggle with that, you know, as far as the justice is.
Sure.
So I guess that's my question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think some people would say every single child that dies, especially maybe in utero or shortly after birth, would go to heaven, and you could probably build a case. You can't point to a specific verse that would say that. You can definitely point to a scriptures that would show that some infants are regenerate in a way that maybe we can't fully understand, that die in infancy or, you know, in John the Baptist and end up going to heaven.
Mike, can I recommend a book?
Yeah.
Actually, I think the best thing I've seen on this is called The Theology of Infant Salvation. The Theology of Infant Salvation is by Webb, W-E-B-B. And you can find it, actually, it's Sprinkle Publications.
Really?
Yeah, it's really the best thing, and one of the only things. There's very, very, very few books on this whole topic. I have their thing right here, as a matter of fact. Okay, so I have it if you want to look at the best thing on. He argues all infants are saved. But I mean, you're talking, he really argues, goes through all the theology, all the different views. That's probably the best thing on it.
Okay. He argues, well, I didn't hear what you said.
He argues in favor that all infants are saved.
MacArthur wrote a book a few years ago called Safe in the Arms of God. That's good too.
That all infants that die are saved?
Yes. If they die in infancy, he believes that they end up in heaven.
Wouldn't that nullify the theory of Adam's imputation of the sin of Adam's imputation, or Adam's sin being imputed to other humans after him?
I bet Webb deals with that in the book.
because the discussion about infant salvation, it relates to the doctrine of sin, but it's also about the doctrine of salvation,
yeah,
which is not what you're talking about.
Right.
The question becomes, under what conditions does God impute righteousness?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Assume he imputes sin or guilt at all, regardless of what the basis is, and there are different opinions about that, but assume that the infant is guilty. Well, the question then becomes not are they guilty, the question becomes, can God impute righteousness to them? And if he does, what's the basis of
right.
that? Okay. And that's what the book is about. And he goes to the Calvinistic, the Arminian view, all the views. It's really a superb book. So.
That's a good point. So the immediate imputation, again, is that the sinful nature, that's what's inherited from Adam. There is no sin. We're not responsible or culpable for that first sin. The immediate imputation, which is what most people believe, is that we are born corrupt because we are guilty. All right? Immediate is we are guilty because we're born corrupt. Immediate is we're born corrupt because we are guilty. So death came on all men as a punishment because of one sin and only one sin. This sin was committed by Adam. And this is where you get into the arguments in Romans 5:12 of what does that word sinned mean? Therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. What does sinned mean? Three possible interpretations. It's passive in its meaning, signifying either to be sinful or to be reckoned as having sinned. That's a passive meaning. The verb doesn't lend itself to that. Second meaning, it is active in its meaning and denotes the first sin of each individual after he is born. Okay? The first sin of each individual. In this case, again, sin wouldn't denote Adam's first sin. It would denote each of our own individual's first sin. Then the third possibility is it is active in its meaning and denotes the first sin of Adam, and really us, because his posterity, Adam's posterity, being one with him, either by natural union or by representation, or both together, we sinned. So the evidence seems to indicate this. Let me explain why the third option is preferred. One, the verb is active. It's not passive. Second, it's in the aorist tense, the past tense. There's a number of tenses in Greek. The aorist tense means it is a completed action. So when he says, all sinned, how could Paul be talking about us as individuals when many people hadn't even been born yet, right? We hadn't been born. And many children die in infancy before even committing that first sin. So if you tried to argue from that, then you run into a problem of, yeah, the kid is innocent because he's never committed that first sin. So what Paul is saying is something happened that was completed in the past that applies to all men. Something completed in the past that happened to all men. When Adam sinned, God considered it true that all men sinned.
But I'm still trying to get it. What right do we have to be in fellowship with God? If Adam, Adam loses the right, and he doesn't have any right to pass to his children. So in a sense, if sin disqualifies from heaven, we don't have any right natural. We enter heaven. The infant enters heaven. It's not that right, it's by grace.
Right. Yeah, the imputation of righteousness.
There's nothing that right that we have to have a fellowship with them.
Sure.
That's given to us by grace. So Adam, he lost that right.
Right. I agree.
He gives it to us by grace.
Yes. He imputes his righteousness.
So maybe the infant can't act in faith, but it's still received by grace.
Sure. Okay, so when Adam sinned, God's considered it true that all men sinned. Whether you want to argue and believe it's from the physical, you know, the union, the natural union in his loins, or whether you want to argue it's from his representing us as the covenant head of humanity. He imputed Adam's sin to us. Thus, we are guilty. Why are we guilty? Part of the challenge is you can't, and Dan probably knows this better than any of us, you can't divide guilt. You really can't divide guilt. If two people murder one person, they're both, whatever, taking their knives and stabbing him to death, do you divide the guilt in half so that neither of them are worthy of capital punishment? No, they're both deserving of capital punishment. In fact, in some states, I don't know if it's in this state, but if you commit a felony and in the process of doing that someone gets killed, whoever committed that felony, even if they didn't shoot the person, they're all guilty of murder. Is that true in Missouri?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so you're doing a bank robbery with you and two of your buddies, and your friend makes a bad decision and shoots one of the clerks, you're all toast. You're all guilty of murder. So you can't divide the guilt. You can't divide it. Another illustration, some men go into business with one another and one of them's making horrible decisions and ends up doing some illegal things. In some circumstances, all of the business partners are responsible. So even though it's one person, you know, in that sense, that one person was representing the company. They're all, the business owners are responsible. What do you think about that, Rick? another example would be, you know, if someone commits murder and they're stabbing that person, you know, over and over with their hand. I mean, could their defense be, no, well, that was my hand. That wasn't my whole body. That was just my hand that killed the person. I mean, it's your guilt.
It's the knife.
Or the knife, yeah.
Is their father
guns
involved?
Kill people.
Yeah. You know, guilt essentially by association. The entirety of the person is guilty. So what does imputation mean? Burkhoff talks about two things. Original guilt is the term. That means we're all guilty because of Adam's sin. We're all guilty. However you want to cut it, slice it, or look at it, we are all guilty because of that one sin. So that's original guilt. And then original pollution simply means we have the tendency to sin now. We have that bent towards sin. We have been polluted. So this entails that in our natures, we totally lack any spiritual good before God as unregenerate men and women. And in our actions, we are totally unable to do spiritual good before God. The unregenerate man cannot please God. So we have a corrupt nature and we have a bent towards sin. Now some say, as I think Chris was mentioning earlier, I mean, is this fair? That we are guilty because our representative or our union with Adam. I mean, is that fair? Everyone who has ever said that and everyone who has never said that has committed numerous acts of sin worthy of condemnation. And when you look at what the judgment is going to entail, the scripture always talks about Romans 2:6. God will render it to every man according to his works. According to his works. Colossians 3:25. The wrongdoer will be paid back for the wrong he has done. So, in that sense, the person who wishes that wouldn't have been imputed to him, I mean, you're just essentially blowing smoke because you've already committed enough sins that you didn't even have to be imputed to you. Others would say, if you were in Adam's shoes, you would have done the exact same thing. Now, that's a hypothetical situation which, yeah, if we were really honest with ourselves, would we? Probably. But, again, that's more hypothetical. The best argument is, if you think it's unfair to be represented by Adam, then you have to think it's unfair to be represented by Christ. Because we definitely didn't deserve to be represented by him in any sense of the imagination. So, and I don't think we want to argue that. The good news is, and that's what I usually tell people, because some people that I've shared with before have brought that up, you know, Catholics especially with the whole original sin and Adam, is I just say, look, you're right. He made the decision, it affected you, but the hope of redemption is placed before you right now. So the curse can be removed, and you can have newness of life. And so you can point to Adam all you want when you stand before God someday, but if you don't have Christ's righteousness poured upon you, then it's not going to make a difference. So God's provided the answer, and it's up to you if you want to receive it or not. So what are the effects of our original sin on our corrupt nature? Blindness and darkness. Isaiah 42:7, Revelation 3:17. The conscience is insensible and stupefied. Romans 1 talks about, you know, the seared conscience, Romans 1:25. Pollution of the mind, Titus 1:15. And then in regards to our will, you know, we have enmity, hatred, hardness of heart, aversion, obstinacy. So, original sin means that unregenerate men are inclined to all evil. Look at Romans 3, verse 10. In verse 9, he says, "What then? Are we Jews any better off? No, not at all. For we have already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, are under sin. As it is written, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God." So the inability to seek after God relates to the spiritual good. When we are inclined to all evil, it does not include the family affections. It does not include social affections. It does not include civil affections like patriotism. It doesn't even include, you know, aesthetic feelings. You know, you can see art and appreciate it and have good feelings about it. It is the moral inability to incline rightly from a wrong state of the will, to convert the sinful inclination into holy inclination. We cannot change the will. We cannot will to be what we are in our nature. We can't will it to be different. If we have been given a sinful nature, then all we know how to do is sin. That's all we know how to do. A renewed nature brings us back, really, to the garden. Now we have the ability to not sin. The glorified nature, we're not able to sin. So moral ability and moral obligation. We'll just finish up with a couple things. What's the basis for our moral obligation? What's the basis for our sinless obedience? Adam was given a holy inclination. He had the ability to obey. Our inability today, this is what Charnock says, did not result from the nature of the law, but from the corrupted nature of the creature. It did not result from the nature of the law, but from the corrupted nature of the creature. So, then you get into, well, if the unbeliever is always bent towards sin, I mean, is that even really fair? Because all they know how to do is sin and sin and sin and sin and sin, and then they're held accountable for that sin. How can that work? Well, here's what he went on to say. Destroying our ability does not destroy our obligation. Destroying our ability does not destroy our obligation. If ability is weakened or destroyed by an act of self-determination, Adam chose it. If ability is weakened by an act of self-determination, obligation is not weakened. I was thinking about this today, and I was actually talking to Chris about there's people that have been living in their houses that decided to stop paying their mortgages. I mean, just stopped. And Chris was saying in some states you can... 18 months can be the process in some states to, from the first day they start the whole foreclosure process to get you out of the house. And they were talking about these people that had been living in their house and had not made a payment, you know, in 2 years. And some of the banks are so overwhelmed in some of these other states that basically they're just trying to figure out how much is it worth and, you know, all those different things. Missouri, you know, I think it's 90 days, right? Yeah. So someone who has a mortgage but doesn't have the ability to pay the mortgage, that doesn't wipe away their obligation to pay the mortgage, does it? The debt is still there. So even though people have lost their jobs, as horrible as that is, and they're in these homes that maybe they now can't afford, so they don't have the ability to pay the mortgage, they still have the obligation. And that's really, you know, even if our ability to obey the law has been destroyed or weakened, that doesn't take away from our obligation to obey the law. Which then it gets into, and it'll probably be visited more in the future, but free will. You know, how free is the will? That's really the question. Even the staunchest of Calvinists, if he's truly honest with himself, admits that there's a freedom to the will in some form. So the freedom of the will is a self-determination to evil for the unregenerate man. Nothing forces the man to choose evil. There is no external force that forces him to do the heinous acts that unregenerate man. No man can say, I did not determine to do this. It was not my will to do this. Now they might claim that in court, but I was forced to do this. People, what's that? The devil made me do it. He willingly chooses evil. Freedom from compulsion, either internal or external. Thus, man is not forced to good or evil. He's freed from any compulsion. Unregenerate man is not compelled to do anything. There's nothing driving him externally to do that. It comes from his nature. That's unregenerate man. Regenerate man, the Holy Spirit re-originates the self-determination. It re-originates it. so that we have the inclination to the good. Within that whole scope, you get into total depravity. All right? If you're familiar with TULIP, total depravity. This is what that means. It's the entire absence of holiness. Some theologians prefer complete depravity. Because total depravity, you know, you get this picture of people running around like complete anarchy, you know. Total depravity, humanity at its worst. I watched this movie the other night, and it was humanity at its worst. So some like complete depravity. It's the entire absence of holiness. It's not the highest intensity of sin. All right, each of us in our unregenerate states, we were at different places in the intensity of our sin. It's the absence of holiness which was characteristic to all of us. So a totally depraved man is not as bad as he can be, but he has no holiness. He has no love of God, no desire to serve him, no supreme love of him. He worships and loves, fill in the blank, the creature, the creation, himself, whatever. But he never chooses to love God. It's when you talk about the imputation, it is interesting to think about I was trying to think of some examples what if they would either fall into representative or the physical. We were in his loins union. And I was thinking about the sin of Achan, you know, because a lot of times people really harp on that, and how could, you know, Achan takes all this stuff from the war and he hides it under his tent, then he confesses it, and what do? They bring out, it says, his children and everything, and they stone him and they burn him. And I was like, dude, I mean, you read that, you're like, wow. And there's many lessons there you could draw in terms of head of the family. But again, it gets to that idea that, you know, when we are in different positions, whether we're the boss, whether we're the head of the family, whether we're the leaders in the church, that has an effect that we probably don't even fully realize. And many people have said, I'll never be like my dad. Many ladies have said, I'll never be like my mom. And what ends up happening? They're like their mom. They're like their dad. That influence over and over, that's being under that authority over and over, impacts that person. And if Achan's one sin pretty much damns his whole family, I mean, that would be the argument that you would get. Some people would say that that was an undeserved punishment for his family. Some would say it was a deserved punishment. That would be the argument. But you see that time and time again where these men in key positions, head of the family, head of the nation, head of the church, and the destruction or the blessing flows down for all the people under them. And it's something I think that we need to take to heart as the men of our families, to realize that we represent our families. You know, so David's talked before about, you know, interceding for our families, confessing their sin. And, you know, sometimes I feel like, me personally, I get to the point where I'm like, I'm doing really good, Lord. You and me are doing good. And then I come home and my wife's like, oh, I got this serious problem I'm dealing with, or I got this issue. I'm like, and then, you know, half of me wants to be like, okay, well, I hope that works out. You know, good luck with that. Me and God are good, so you go get good. But, you know, but the truth is that I am responsible for her. If I am the head of the family, if I am the representative, then it falls upon me. Her problem is my problem. So when she comes home, then all of a sudden I'm like, okay, Lord, well, I'm still going to be good with you, but now I'm going to minister and work in my wife's life to get her to a place where she is good with you and she's walking in fellowship with you. And that's a daunting task as men of the head of our families. But we need to realize that with our wives and with our children. I mean, it's not just a vertical relationship. It's like this giant circle, you know, that all of our family is included in, and we are directing and molding and guiding them And the scriptures, if anything, prove that out, regardless of what position you take on some of these things. It's incumbent upon us to make sure that we are the good representatives of whatever position God puts us in. I'll pray and we'll be done.